This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Tasha Fussell. Now, when we think of bucket lists, things that we want to do and places that we dream of visiting, it involves going in search of someplace new and exotic. And there are so many different ways to go about this. You know, there are tours and packages that suit every taste, depending on your budget and the experience that you're after. But recently, I came across a specific type of travel that I found pretty interesting. Some of you may have heard of it. It's called slum tourism.
Part of the reason behind Cartagena's increasing tourism is a phenomenon known as slum tourism.
Slum tourism is tourism to impoverished urban areas. And at least part of the attraction tends to be the impoverished living conditions of the people. So you could say that it's poverty, really, that has become the attraction.
Slum tourism is a growing global industry. Each year, tens of thousands of curious visitors are choosing to bypass the typical tourist vacation destinations in favor of poverty-stricken slums in cities like Mumbai, Johannesburg, and Rio de Janeiro. And of course, this brings up certain questions, like, is it immoral to turn these slums into a tourist attraction? Or could it in fact be one of the better ways to try and confront the realities of inequality and poverty that is so obviously happening around us? To help us answer that, I speak to a professor who's pretty well acquainted with these questions.
Yes, hello. My name is Fabian Frenzel. I'm associate professor in organization studies, the University of Leicester in the United Kingdom. One of my main research areas is the study of tourism in areas of urban poverty, also known as slum tourism.
So what exactly is a slum tour? Well,
a slum tour is most easily described and most often takes place as a walking tour or a visit of perhaps 3-4 hours to a neighborhood. So what will happen in most of the cases is that tourists will be staying in their hotel or other accommodation and now be picked up by a tour provider. A guided tour then pursues with perhaps 5-6 other tourists. You'd be driven or taken to the township or favela or the slum and walk around there. And in the context of life in this neighborhood, in this informal neighborhood, will be introduced. There's a variety of aspects to this. There's often, in some places, a focus on, obviously, on how people live. So sometimes that involves simply looking at houses. There'll be sometimes a case of not exactly a visit to someone's house, but like a setup, an artificial setup where you can see how a house looks like from the inside. Sometimes there's a focus on industry as well. You'll find that many neighborhoods and many cities, in fact, have a mixture of residential and more commercial usages. So in some of the tours, they'll be look at the way people work, essentially. And then on to things like schools and other facilities as well. It's often a site of interest. And in some cases, there's an addition of maybe visiting a restaurant or also a pub at the end of the tour. So that could be also an element.
So it sounds like you'll find that maybe the tour is very different perhaps from the images or the ideas that you have in your head just from watching films, from thinking of the word slum.
Yes, absolutely. So for many people, they come in there wondering what it's like. You know, is it all squalor? Is it all terrible? And then often the tourists work on the surprise factor, how relatively normal lives are, how regulated lives are, how they follow certain patterns. And how it's far from being a straightforward. Poverty is a complex phenomenon which, when it's spatialized in particular neighborhoods, is often much more around perception. And then, of course, neglect. So there's also there's a clear sign there, often in those tours where tourists realize that there's a difference between the sort of the idea of perhaps slums as something where, you know, are not doing anything or they have no work, to a realization that these are actually very hard-working neighborhoods. In fact, they have to be for survival, and a lot of work takes place. And what's lacking is not that, but what's lacking is recognition of that work, recognition of the labor being put in by people in these areas. So that lack of recognition translates into a lack of public services, for example, so that neighborhoods perhaps have a limited sewage provision, or that schools and transport infrastructures are not as they should be, considering that these are neighborhoods of the city. So it's a problem of the city. It's not a problem of the people living there. I mean, it's their problem. They have to face it every day, but it's not their fault, if you see what I mean. So there's a pedagogical side to these tours that's very important.
Now, when you first heard about slum tourism, you said you found it remarkable. What was it about the entire experience or the entire practice of it that you found interesting? And what were your initial knee-jerk reactions to it? Because I watched a video where there was this group about to embark on a slum tour, and one of the guys said that he expects to see poverty, but there's beauty in everything. And when I heard that, I couldn't help but feel, ooh, that sounds like a bit of an insensitive or ignorant perspective to take, but that might be a snap judgment on my part.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that the fact that this curiosity exists, and, you know, travel in some ways, a lot about curiosity, you know, to see differences. And so curiosity is often based on, of course, curiosity is basically a condition of ignorance, right? I mean, we're curious because we're ignorant. We don't know things, so we need to find out. So while I can totally understand your feeling, and I had those reactions initially, you know, you're like, oh my God, this is terrible. I still also knew that I had that same curiosity as a researcher. You know, I'd be interested to see and understand how different people live in different parts of the world. It's not that big difference to how most tourists feel. There's a similar curiosity. And I find it, upon reflection, I find it much better when people are kind of saying, okay, I have this curiosity, I'm ignorant, I'm going out and trying to find out how things actually look like. That's something that I think is to be applauded as an approach. Now, it doesn't mean that every single practice of a tourist or tourist walking into slum areas is to be applauded. That's an important difference. But I think fundamentally, as a practice, we should not be negative about it. I think it's good when people are curious and addressing their ignorance by, you know, exploring.
What would you say is that the core of that curiosity?
Well, I think at the core there is this interest in how other people live. Curiosity is obviously, in our today's world, it's not something that just naturally comes to us. It has to be provoked. There's big themes, that narrative stories that we all familiar with. All in different ways familiar with. So when it comes to questions of poverty, these are really big stories that go back a long time, about the relationship between rich and poor and how this is played out. And these stories then are represented today in films. So you find, for example, that many tourists are curious about slums like the big neighborhood Dharavi in Mumbai because they've watched Slumdog Millionaire as a movie before, and then life in that neighborhood was displayed in the movie. And that's a story they tap into, and a story that creates curiosity. It's a story that relates to these older stories that we have about what's life like under conditions of disadvantage. How do you make a life? How can you persevere under these conditions and so forth? So I think that curiosity is not just something that comes out of nowhere. It's related to stories we're quite familiar with from early on. And these stories go back a long time. They're not just recent movies, but obviously these recent movies tend to provoke it immediately. But the stories are much older. In many different traditions, you find the stories, but just in a sort of UK, British context, you find Charles Dickens having these big stories in the 19th century about life and poverty and perseverance. And those stories continue to resonate and ask that question about how people will live under poor conditions and how things are set up. So I think the curiosity, individually, the motivations are very different, but you find these patterns that people relate to. Shared stories and so forth.
And I think what you said earlier about how these are not just random things that happen, right? They are reactions to stories and narratives that you hear that pique your curiosity. And yeah, that's very true. And it's just, I guess, a matter of luck, which of these areas get highlighted and which don't, and whether or not that there is any good that comes from it.
That's a real issue. That's a real issue as well. It's a matter of luck. And when the stories come out of certain areas and in others, I mean, it's one of the issues. So Mumbai is a great example for that because all the attention goes to Dharavi, but there is a huge neighborhood. And even within that huge neighborhood, only certain areas are ever affected and never get any visitors. But there's so many other places in town. So what do you do about that? You know, do you expand to those? Does it make sense? Is that a model that, like, kind of makes sense in this way? Or can, like, one neighborhood stand in for all of them? If you talk symbolically, then perhaps it can, right? If it's not so much about the daring contributions, but about the symbolic ones, then yes, one neighborhood can stand for all of them to some extent. But yeah, you find, for example, in Rio de Janeiro, that in some neighborhoods, the urban policy, the municipality has decided to invest in certain infrastructure now it was a couple of years ago, to invest in certain infrastructure that they knew would be transport infrastructure, they knew would be useful for the residents, but at the same time would also enable tourists to get there more easily. So that was kind of an attempt by the municipality to say, well, maybe we can get some tourists to go there. You know, so an attempt to kind of get that thing going artificially almost, you know, that's not accidental anymore, but that you say, can we roll this out, this phenomenon, to other neighborhoods? So that was quite interesting when that happened.
And I suppose that like kind of begs the question of what commercialization will do to the industry itself. Mm-hmm. It will cease to become what it is if it becomes more and more popular.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it's an integrative process, isn't it? But like what many people find is that on the tours, it's a little bit around trying to understand as well, you know, what's attractive about neighborhoods and why people like to see neighborhoods and how people actually live. And that sort of extends a little bit the question of poverty. It's a more general question of like what you're after in urban tourism. And there's definitely some sort of drive in, across the board for this sort of interest in neighborhoods and how they look like and how people actually live and so forth. And that's, I think that would apply really broadly. It's just more interesting to some extent than simply watching, like, looking at museums and CBDs, which globally tend to look the same and have the same shops and the same sort of shopping centers and layouts. And when you go into the neighborhoods, you find perhaps more varieties, more life, vibrant life. In slum tourism, a lot of that is active. And people just enjoy living and seeing and being part of those vibrant neighborhoods. Where, you know, life takes place on the street a lot more and people are out and about and it's not so formalized and closed off like often city centers are. It's the life, isn't it? The encounters that come with it, the potential encounters, the kind of being and sort of having a sense of being immersed in it, that plays a big role there. And I find that is one of the most dominant tropes in tourism anyway, you know, to try to go beyond what's presented to you. In poorer neighborhoods, some of that comes across because there's life, there are things that happen. So it's then valuing that and then saying like, look, this is really nice, actually, this is much better. Why then, given this is so much nicer and so much more vibrant, why then within the city people think of this as a bad neighborhood? Why within the city people think this is all the criminals there or it's dangerous, or, you know, when actually I have much better experience here as a tourist than anywhere else in the city? How does that square? And that contradiction is a disruption, I think, and that brings back those questions of justice and how to address it.
I'm with Dr. Fabian Frenzel talking about this phenomenon of slum tourism. Fabian himself has gone on dozens of these tours, so we'll talk more about his experiences and observations when we come back. It's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Best flipping moments, BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's the Evening Edition. I'm Tasha Fusil, and I'm speaking tonight to Dr. Fabian Frenzel, who is a lecturer in political economy of organization at the University of Leicester. He's also the founder of slumtourism.net, a website that looks into the research of the slum tourism industry and the impact that it's having on some of the most impoverished neighborhoods around the world. We've been talking about what slum tourism is and what perhaps motivates a person to want to take up these kinds of activities when they're traveling or when they're on vacation. But Fabian, talk to me about what your experiences have been like going to the slums, especially in different parts of the world, because, you know, from the outset, it would seem kind of convenient to label all of these neighborhoods as slums, but it's probably too broad of a term. I mean, if you think of a neighborhood in India, for example, versus one in LA.
Yes, it's a broad stroke, and in the end, when you find the differences in different places, you have to recognize those. So there's important differences between, you know, say a tour in a favela in Rio de Janeiro and a tour in Dharavi in Mumbai, in terms of their foci, in terms of the stories that are being told and the way it's set up. At the same time, you'll find that there's some shared patterns between those tours, and they go beyond places. And this is this combination of the curious thing that you find cities have neighborhoods, more recognized neighborhoods and less recognized neighborhoods, and that this is a pattern that exists almost everywhere. The less recognized neighborhoods are often the ones where people more recently moved to the city, and they moved into the city on a low entry point. So they're what's also been described as arrival cities. People often move into the city from more rural contexts in these areas. They're low entry points, so low-level entry, meaning you can enter the city there with limited budgets. You enter on the lowest level of the labor market. But it is still a progress, if you want, socially, for the people involved, from having very poor rural lives to starting to have urban lives. And those patterns are very comparable. So when in slum tourism these patterns are discussed and described, you again come to similar conclusions. The question is, okay, how does a city deal with its latest immigrants who come in, like the latest immigrants, urban immigrants? You know, people move into the city, how are they being treated? Is their labor, is their contribution recognized? And you find that the problems or the conflicts are very similar in a variety of different places across the world.
Talk to me about the communities that live in these areas. You know, what sort of industries would you find that they're involved in? You know, and you talk about being recognized, having their rights recognized, or having access to certain facilities. Is that all sort of just really dependent on the city? Do the kids get to go to school? You know, those kinds of things.
Yeah, it's very different depending on the city, indeed. I mean, the places I looked at have, so there's very different industries. There's also different legal statuses and statuses of recognition depending on how long the neighborhoods have been in place. For example, the more industrial looking structures you find in Dharavi around things, well, it's, you know, it's manufacturing more than industry as such, but you know, it's smoky work, if you know what I mean. Like there's fires involved and chemicals involved, for example, in dealing with leather production. That's one example, right? But then in other places, the townships in South Africa are much more, they are much more commuter places. People live there and then they commute to work somewhere else. The infrastructure is set up for it. It has to do with the history of how these places in South Africa were formed, because they were formed with an idea of separation of work and housing. But, you know, work still takes place, often manufacturing. In Brazil, the context of labor and work is again one that takes place mostly outside. The favelas, there's a lot of service workers and sort of female labor in the context of housekeeping and so forth, and then more male labor in the context of building work, but also security and driving and other services like this. So it depends on the local economy a lot what takes place. And then you have the differences in status of, you know, are people there recognized as citizens? Do you have full citizen rights? In some places you have international migrations into these neighborhoods. It's mostly the case actually in more industrialized countries. And the question of like, what is the citizenship status? For example, everyone has Brazilian citizenship. That's not a question, but you have cases in which the immigrants of poor neighborhoods, of disregarded neighborhoods, additionally face those exclusions of not having the same citizens' rights, which compounds the exclusion. That's similar, by the way, in some neighborhoods in South Africa, where you have immigration from other African countries. So, there's a variety of different layers to forms of exclusion that's taking place. But again, what's shared, I think, is a perception that even if there's full citizenship rights on paper, there's a sense of people not being fully represented, not having full voice, which has to do with socioeconomic status, with the fact that they're relatively poor in comparison to the rest of the people in the city.
And when you've been on these tours and you've observed other tourists on the tour, how aware are they of these layers? You know, how much do they get to understand and get proper insights into the lives and the complex social problems that these communities are experiencing?
Yeah, that is a very important question. You would think that like in 3 hours, 4 hours, how much can you convey of this sort of complexity of a situation and so forth? And often the pedagogical messages, in fact, you have to understand the tours are organized by tour guides, and these tour guides decide on like a particular story to tell because they're focused, they simplify. You know, they have to, in 3 hours, they will simplify the story a little bit down to like something that is easily understood. It will sometimes cover aspects of what I just told you. I mean, there's a lot more to talk about local context and so forth. It will, however, always be limited by that time frame and by, you know, the necessity of making a somewhat, you know, conclusive story within 3 or 4 hours of tour guiding, you know, when clearly to actually create a full picture of that situation in any local context, you would need much more time. So that's the one side. So yes, the information that's being transferred is limited. However, I find remarkable, and I've looked into this a little bit, how more and more has to be done, I guess, in terms of research to find out about this, how people are, tourists are, getting this information, and then some may just take it and, you know, put it into their stash of holiday memories and go back home, and that's that. Others are saying, well, that's very interesting, but I see some more questions here. I want to get more involved. I want to understand more. And you find phenomena such as people then saying returning on their own behalf, maybe, you know, without the help of a tour guide this time, finding their own way in. Often it's like opening a space up that happens. Like maybe you take the tour in the first instance and then you learn that it's actually absolutely fine to walk by yourself. And then the second time you come in and look for some more experiences, some more conversations and so forth. So there's limited evidence of that. I guess it's like from a research perspective, you know, I guess it's one of the phenomena that I'm interested in. How does, is there like a sort of a biography, like a learning story for people who go on the 3-4 hour tour with all its limits first, but then in the second and third step, get more involved, get more information. And that's definitely a possibility that arises and a reality of what's happening to some extent from those tours.
And how about those who are living in the favelas, in the shantytowns themselves? How do they respond to, and I'm sure this is a question that you get a lot, how do they respond to strangers, tourists dropping in on their in their spaces to see them?
Yeah, again, it depends a lot on context. You'll find that there's an assumption that perhaps it's intrusive or something. It really depends on the urban context you're facing. If you think of large neighborhoods, large complex neighborhoods in which it's not like that everybody knows each other in the first place. It's, you know, not at all. I just imagine a big city context, right? People are strangers to each other most of the time, and there's not that sort of close-knit communities where immediately when someone else rocks up, that becomes like, oh my God, who's this person? No, we're talking of neighborhoods with hundreds of thousands of people in them. So, you know, clearly if just because some group walks through there with people who don't normally live there, that no one raises an eyebrow. People go on about their normal business just as everywhere else. Having said that, there's sometimes racial patterns that kind of indicate that there's a group of people who aren't normally there, which is quite clear. What I found quite interesting is that in that, if that happens, say a group of white people walking through a black neighborhood, that the reversal of the gaze often takes place. You know, there's actually the people who've been taking pictures of are not necessarily the people who live there, but the tourists,
right? You know,
because that's so exceptional. So you have like, all sorts of kind of reversals of that. You know, look at what's going on. I had the experience in Mumbai with a group of activists and architects in a poor neighborhood in Mumbai, where people were also like kind of sort of getting really curious and saying like, what are you doing here? You know, you're supposed to go to like the gate of India and not be in our neighborhood. Like, so there is that recognition sometimes, but I think it's too much to say that this immediately will cause, you know, oh my God, they're just coming here to look at us. And in fact, the research that has been done to ask people about how they find this often says like, it's great. You know, there's also a sense of hospitality, but like, if you break it down to some of the more meaty issues of like, okay, so really they pay for this, but they don't have to pay for this. They can just come, we'll show them around anyway. You know, so there's this kind of question around this of like the commercialization of it. There's people are kind of, if not angry with it, they're kind of surprised. Like, that's not necessary. They can just come and like, you know, we can show them around. And so there's questions like that obviously come up. And then there's incidences as well of very insensitive behavior and so forth. And problem where people act with their cameras insensitively and just holding cameras into people's faces and so forth. And that's a problem that you have across the board though in tourism. I think it's not specific for this kind.
When we return with Dr. Fabian Frenzel, we'll look at the cost of going on a slum tour and where our tourist dollars are actually going. It's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Beyond Frivolous Matters, BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
You're back on the Evening Edition. I'm Tasha Fasil, and tonight's guest is Dr. Fabian Frenzel, a lecturer in political economy of organization at the University of Leicester. Fabian's been researching the area of slum tourism and the ethics of it. And perhaps one of the biggest questions to pop up from the discussion of slum tourism is what sort of benefit it can bring to the communities that are living in these slums. Do these tours provide any sort of viable income, and who profits most from all the activity? That's something I wanted to find out when I asked about the cost of a tour and where the money actually goes.
Actually, $15 to about $40, $45, I think. It really depends on that, but this is kind of the tour price range. It's more expensive in some places, less expensive in others. But yeah, that's the range. And normally this money will be used to pay the guides. In the case of tour operators that operate as part of larger tourism organizations, there'll be some money that goes to the larger tourism organization. You know, so that's a structure you have a lot in South Africa. So you have like overarching tour operators they're basically calling points for tourists, and they offer a range of different things. You say, okay, you want a township tour, okay, we'll put that in. They'll then organize the tour and the transport and then kind of pay the local guides to come in. So there, in that case, most of the money will be going either to the guide or more of it even remain with the larger scale tourism organization outside the township. And that's of course, controversial. It's a problem. There's other operators who say, okay, we don't want to do this. We want some of the money to come back into the communities. So they make a very, you know, in some cases, very sophisticated project and also accounting mechanism, which they show, which they display and show, look, some of our money, we need to fund the operations and to pay for the guides, but then whatever we make in profits will go to fund projects in the neighborhood of some description, you know, where we cooperate with local tour guides. So I guess it's up for the tourists to a little bit to look out and to look into the offerings and say, like, okay, can I see here commitment to supporting, to make sure that some of the money that's been made is also channeled back into the local community? It's very important that tourists do that.
And I suppose this is the part that's a little bit sketchy about the entire thing, is that you don't know where the money is channeled into and what the motives are of the tour operators themselves. Some of them might say that they are doing this to help the community, but, you know, there's no guarantee of that.
Yeah, absolutely. There is no guarantee. I mean, there's that element, and it's something if companies are saying, okay, we're just offering the service, and yes, the money will go to us, and they'll be honest about it. But right. It's obviously worse if people are saying this is channeled to the community, but then it doesn't. Because you could argue that, okay, there's a service being provided, and that service should be paid in some ways, right? Like entering the space and so forth. I find it's interesting how tourists are obviously quite skeptical and quite they want to know. Like, and I found that a lot. A lot of the operators are responding to this. The answer that many operators do is like, so our guides are local tour guides. And for many tourists, it seems to be a crucial factor. It serves two purposes. On the one hand, is a local tour guide will be someone who obviously knows the neighborhood much better and has connection there. On the other hand, it also means that the money does actually flow back into the community in some way, even though it's only into that one person. But for a tourist, that seems to be an okay deal, if you see what I mean, like on that level. How do you scrutinize those claims? It's very difficult, of course, to some extent, for a tourist to scrutinize this. And you can only look at what the operators put on their display and, like, judge by that. It's quite interesting how you find that tourists themselves are starting to, of course, being involved in quality assessment of some description. We all know about TripAdvisor and the way that things are being evaluated by tourists themselves publicly and openly. And it's worthwhile looking into this. You often find, like, some good information on there. There's also an effort by some tour operators to create a bit more official system of saying we have certain criteria that we subscribe to and maybe create some sort of standard around this. There's attempts to do that in a variety of locations.
So if you look at the impact that this has, there's the economic impact, there's the social impact that it's going to have. What would you say is the most important thing to understand about slum tourism and why it can should be acceptable, I suppose?
Yeah, I think we'll be talking a lot about the sort of the face value money that's being created in those tours by, you know, by providing the service or taking people in there by the payment that's being done. And if you look at the overall figures of this and then you square that with the sort of challenges we're facing in terms of alleviating poverty or raising levels of standards of living in those neighborhoods, I think it's very obvious from the simple figures that, like, it can't be an answer to the problems of relative neglect financially. It can't be an answer to just say, okay, we're just going to send some tourists in and make sure that their tourist dollars are being then equally distributed. That wouldn't be enough. Thing is, these neighborhoods are already producing a lot of wealth and resources, and they don't get a fair share of that. That's completely outside of tourism. That's just they're contributing their work, their labor to a vibrant city and so forth. The problem is they don't get the recognition. So I think for me, slum tourism's contribution is to addressing this issue. It's much more on the level of the symbolic and the social impacts rather than the direct economic impact. Yes, there's some money being turned over in slum tourism, and the question of the distribution of that money is a crucial question of justice. But if a tourist attention on neighborhoods raises their profile, enables questioning the neglect they receive and leads to questions of, like, distributive justice within those societies and beyond on a sort of on a global scale, because, you know, because tourism brings in people from outside the country into these discussions. It's complex, right? But, like, in a way that it raises those questions it can have much bigger impact by saying, like, okay, you know, we have this issue. Like, what's going on? Like, why do these people live in these fairly neglected neighborhoods? Is that necessary? What are the political social conditions that lead to this? Asking those questions. Again, I don't want to overestimate the 3 to 4 hour tours in contributing to this, but in some ways, they're better placed in doing the symbolic work. And we've seen the transformation of neighborhoods in which tourism plays a part to get more recognition and to get more understanding. And one of the things I always like to emphasize is when you start being able to tell your story to people from the outside, like to say, well, this is how my life is unfolded, this is how we live and so forth, that creates a possibility to then kind of become aware yourself of the limitations of the perhaps injustices that are suffered. I mean, I'm not saying people aren't aware of that, but just to kind of put it into words that then can be translated into demand of more recognition. So it's a symbolic process. And I've been trying, in my work, I've been trying to break this down, how does this actually look like? So, for example, you find today that tourists, visitors, are not just coming for 3-4 hours. In many of these neighborhoods, you have guest houses that are formed. They'll stay overnight. They stay for a longer period of time. Those guest houses serve as zones in which people meet each other, right? So there's encounters taking place. There's conversations about, okay, so why don't you have water all day? You know, why is electricity so shaky? That sort of conversations, which then lead to, well, can we do something about this? Where the different perspectives, just the conversation about it, perhaps open spaces of demanding those things more successfully than before, and where I think tourism can contribute in that way. So I think, yes, to sum up, the symbolic contribution of tourism is potentially much, much more promising than the narrowly understood economic contribution through money spent on tours.
It's an interesting thing where attaching the prospect of it being part of a vacation experience, it might be the case that more people are open to visiting these areas when it's outside their country, but they're much less comfortable doing that with communities within their own country. Do you find that that's the case?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's one of the ironies about this. It's like that you find people ignoring certain injustices at home and going to other places. For me, it's a moral problem, and it's kind of the way, you know, we sometimes are. It's easier to perhaps look at injustices in other places than at home. But obviously, it's an encouragement for people to do this more frequently in some way, because if we all help each other out and address some of the injustices that we ourselves are less inclined or less able to see at home, then everybody wins, right? So it's about opening this up and saying that, yes, it is remarkable when people from the United States or from Great Britain or from Germany move to South Africa and Brazil and say, oh, look, what's going on here, all this poverty. I find the next step would be, and the important step would be for South Africans, Brazilians, and so forth to come to the U.S., to Germany, and to the U.K. Yeah. And point out, look, this is where you are overlooking, you know, your issues. And I think that's, to some extent, that's starting to happen, partly because in the globalizing tendencies we have, inequality is not so much the thing anymore that's neatly connected to one country, right? I mean, there's inequalities across borders and across boundaries, and with global migration movements, that's certainly the case. And there's a big talk in Europe about the return of informal neighborhoods in Europe because of sort of years of neglect. So, you know, there's not like this linear process, unfortunately, in which we can say, oh, yeah, you know, it's just a question of time, and some countries have already reached it. Unfortunately, the struggle is happening on many different levels. So, yeah, so there is that, I totally agree, there is that phenomenon of, like, going out somewhere and, like, in that way projecting. In fact, slums themselves are a great example of that. The whole discourse of slums, the idea of, like, poverty is a problem of one area, when really the whole city has that problem, right? It's just that it's, you know, in the discourse and in the discussions and to some extent in the urban form, it's focused in one neighborhood, but really the problem is for everyone.
What sort of advice would you give to someone when it comes to approaching the prospects of slum tourism and what it means to be a tourist in these areas, in all areas really, when you're visiting a strange place, a place that's not your own?
Yeah, some general rules apply. I mean, it's looking for friendly helpers, people who are hospitable to guide you around, and keep an open mind. More practically speaking, when it comes to slum tourism, it's really important to kind of spend a bit of time in looking at what's on offer and what different alternatives exist in different places, and not just go for the first best that's been given to you, perhaps in your hotel or guest house, but kind of scrutinize the offers a little bit. There tends to be in every place something that's perhaps a bit more appealing and perhaps a bit more careful in its policies of how it deals with questions of distributions of revenue and involvement of the neighborhood residents than others. It's worth looking for those. It's definitely worth trying to think about a little bit beforehand of like what kind of likely scenario and read up on those issues as well. But by no way, I think, should people who think about this think, but it's immoral to be curious or something, and I shouldn't be looking at people. This is something you can certainly ask your tour guides about, and you can discuss with other tourists, but generally the curiosity is good, and it's worthwhile asking those questions. The other option is to not go, right? That doesn't make the problem go away either. So perhaps there's other answers, perhaps there's other things you could do, but like just to say that I'm not doing this because I don't want to be seem to be voyeuristic or something, but then not do anything, that doesn't help.
That was Dr. Fabian Frenzel speaking to us about the ins and outs of slum tourism and the ethics of it all. To catch up on any of the bits that you might have missed, you can head to www.bfm.my or our BFM app to download the podcast. I'm Tasha Fasil, and this has been the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.